Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
Have you ever heard of that Ötzi, the Iceman they found like in the Alps or whatever, frozen?
Yeah, yes.
He had Lyme disease. They found Borrelia bacteria in him. That's how we know that it's been around at least 5,300 years.
Hey there, this is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. I hope this finds you safe and well. There's a good chance, if you are listening to this, most of the people are finding themselves going into summer, and that means more outside time, even with COVID as a thing that is happening. People are still able to get out and spend some time in nature, and that also means for many places that the opportunity to come across ticks or have ticks come across you. And of course, that leads opportunities for Lyme disease and other tick-borne illnesses. I am so excited to introduce you to Cole Fisher. She is a Lyme disease researcher at the University of Minnesota Duluth. She's also an environmental science educator and a close friend. I was lucky enough to connect up with her when we both were back in college and had some classes together and became fast friends. She has been working with the Lyme disease research for a number of years now and is really knowledgeable about all of the work that they're doing in Lyme's and tick and Lyme disease. Many other things as well, but this is where we're going to focus our efforts today. Today we're going to talk about ticks and Lyme disease and how that works. How do we even get infected from the ticks? And she's going to talk about the particular ticks that carry the bacteria that cause Lyme, as well as how to protect ourselves. We're going to even talk a little bit about the life cycle of the tick and all that fun stuff. Ticks, for being this like tiny little creature, have a lot more cool stuff going on than you might suspect. So very fun. Before we head in, I do want to thank you so very much for listening to the podcast. If you are new to the podcast, welcome. Please feel free to check out some of the other episodes after you've listened to this one, of course, to the many other topics and professionals that we have to share. A huge and very special thank you to all of the Patreon supporters, for those of you who are part of the Wellness Renaissance Patreon community and continue to be. I am so grateful. Thank you so much. You really, I've said it before, but I mean it every time. Your support means so much to me personally and the mission that I'm on, and it really does help keep this podcast going. So thank you so much. You are seen and appreciated more than you know. Which leads me right into saying a few words about our advertising sponsor for the podcast, Green Home Solutions. What in the world does Green Home Solutions do, you might be asking? Well, let me tell you, they are air quality experts. They work with mold, disinfection, and odors. So I just want to throw a couple examples out there. First of all, mold. If you know anybody who has dealt with the health repercussions of having mold in their house or their space for a period of time, it can be life-changing for them. The way that they feel while they're trying to figure it out, and sometimes things and sensitivities that last well going forward. So the sooner you can get rid of it, if it's something that you have concerns about, I highly, highly recommend it. The reason Green Home Solutions is up here is because they were needed by somebody who needed solutions that would fit for people with chemical sensitivities and work. So that's one thing I want to share. But I also want to mention, not only do they handle, say, pet odors or things like that, but if you were to, say, buy a piece of furniture that came from a household that had a smoker inside, and that's something that you cannot deal with as far as the smell goes and that kind of thing, give them a call. That is something that they would take a look into and most likely be able to help you with. So to find Green Home Solutions, go to greenhomesolutions.com. That will get you to the nearest person to you that can help you with whatever issue or questions that you might have. If you're here in Duluth, you can find Steve and his crew at 218-206-9549. All right, let's head on in with Cole and hear about ticks and tick hunting and learn a little bit more about Lyme disease.
Welcome, Cole, to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. Ticks. We're going to talk about ticks and Lyme disease. So I want you to start out, if you would, by talking about, tell us who you are and how you've gotten involved in ticks and Lyme disease and the study that's going on at UMD.
Hi, Judy.
Hello.
I'm Cole Fisher. I'm a Lyme disease researcher and environmental science educator. And I got my undergraduate degree at the University of Minnesota Duluth. And while I was there, I was lucky enough to be part of an internship undergraduate research experience in a Lyme disease research lab run by Dr. Benjamin Clark. And so that kind of like piqued my interest. And so I had actually had Lyme disease in 2014. So this was something that kind of like was kind of hitting close to home.
Became real personal real fast.
Yeah. So being able to work on this research was really fascinating. And originally I was an undergraduate taking care of his bacteria cultures. But as time went on, I got involved in some work for the Minnesota Department of Health after I graduated. And I actually went out in the field and counted and collected ticks for their Lyme disease research. So that's kind of like how this all got started.
While you're talking about your tick hunting experience, talk about, just explain a little bit about what that looks like to actually do that piece of it.
So basically what we do is we have this thing called a drag cloth. It's kind of just like this biggish piece of fabric, and we pull it along the ground behind us in areas where ticks are likely to be found. And depending on what type of study you're doing, you'll stop at predetermined amount of distance and check. So like sometimes we do like 10 meters and then we check, and then we just do another 10 meters and then we check, and then we just do another 10 meters. So then you just predetermine how far you're going to drag your cloth and then how often you're going to stop and check. And ticks, if they're out, they do this thing called questing, where they kind of rear up and they hold out their front two legs to grab on to whatever brushes by them. So typically they're looking for some sort of small animal or maybe a deer, but they're not necessarily going to know the difference. They'll grab onto the cloth, and that's how we catch them. Other types of like collecting devices exist, but this one's usually just like the most straightforward and easiest way. And that's the way I've always collected in any of the studies I've been a part of.
Okay. So you're collecting these ticks in a very particular area. You're keeping track of the area. Is that correct too? So what are you trying to learn from collecting the ticks?
So a lot of research has kind of already been done on the type of environment where ticks are likely to be present. The Minnesota Department of Health has actually like monitored this pretty well. They have done some studies that shows, you know, ticks want to like hang out in areas where they're likely to encounter the type of animals that they feed off of. So generally it's like small mammals, medium-sized mammals, deer. So wherever you're going to find those kinds of animals, that's where you're likely to find ticks. Depending on the species, usually the ticks don't do well in really hot, dry environments. Like the ticks that are common to Minnesota like it to be a little bit cooler, moister. So tend to not see them very much like out in like the middle of a lawn where there's like a lot of sun and the well-maintained grass. This is not like likely to be an area where you'll find ticks because the prey that they eat aren't likely to be in these areas. But especially like a lot of our communities where we do get deer and we do get mice roaming through our backyards, and people have a lot more wooded areas between houses in our communities, then this can still be a problem to have ticks in your yard. Because if you have a deer coming into your yard to like eat your bulbs and you don't like that, but they could be bringing in ticks, so you could still encounter them in your yard.
So the deer come into your yard and they drop ticks, and then of course they attach onto you, and not so good.
Right. So a couple of different things can happen. Ticks go through like these different life stages. They're laid from an egg and then they hatch. And when they hatch, they're looking to feed. And so a tick needs to feed in order to molt and become the next life stage. And so really, they're only looking to feed a few times in their life whenever they're ready to move on to the next stage. So when a tick first hatches, they're super small. They're really hard to see. But this stage is called a larva tick. The larval ticks are super small, super hard to see, but they tend to be low risk for spreading disease because they haven't fed yet. So they haven't had an opportunity to encounter pathogenic organism. Once they take that first meal and they feed on the blood of whatever host animal that they come in contact with, if they pick an animal that happens to be carrying pathogenic organisms, then the next time they feed, they can pass that on to whatever new animal or human that they're feeding on. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah. So what you said, they only live like, or they only feed a couple times in their life. So what is the life cycle of a tick?
So they have that first stage that we talked about, is called the larval stage. Then once they feed and molt, they become a nymph. So then the nymphal stage is kind of like a teenager tick. And so the next time they feed, they molt into the adult stage. And so that's one meal to get from a larva to a nymph, and another meal to get from a nymph to an adult. And then once they're an adult, the female needs to feed so that she can lay eggs. So a male might be on you, it might bite you. But males tend to pose lower risk because they're not going to feed and become fully engorged. Like, if you folks have ever seen pictures of those fully engorged ticks, they look like a big, fat, swollen raisin. That's a female. And so in order to get that big and swollen with blood, she's got to stay attached a long time. And the longer a tick is attached feeding, the more opportunity there is for her to pass pathogenic organisms to you through her bite.
Okay. Is it through their saliva? Like, what are they passing them through to us?
So tick saliva is partly the culprit because they inject the saliva when they bite. And part of the problem is that it kind of like numbs the area. So animals and people are less likely to notice the bite. It also might have some sort of like properties that prevent you from like having a immediate response to it. So they use the saliva, kind of like cements them to you a little bit. So that way, like, your body can't respond to you and you're not as likely to itch if it's slightly, what's the word I'm trying to search for here?
Anesthesia or anesthetic, kind of an anesthetic that.
Yeah. Well, so basically what I'm trying to say is it kind of like numbs you and it helps cement the tick to you. And so when they're injecting that saliva, that's one of the ways like things can get in you. But just like, you know, like mosquitoes have that needle-like nose. Well, like a tick, when it bites you, its mouth parts has this particular almost like tube-like opening. And that is connecting to you so that it can get your blood out. So one of the things, you don't want to like squeeze a tick when it's on you because you don't want it to like squish back out anything it sucked up back into you. That's pretty gross sounding, but you know. You say, like, when you remove a tick, you should try not to squeeze it real tight, but just use, you know, like a tick key or even a pair of tweezers so that you can get real close to the skin and hopefully pull out without squeezing it too hard.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible for the thing that's stuck in you to break off?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you don't want to like twist it or like jerk on it, because then it's more likely to break off those mouthpieces. And like the big risk with that is you could just get like a local infection from those parts. And like there's potentially bacteria on your skin, bacteria on the outside of the tick. I mean, you can get like an infection from those kinds of bacteria too. But that's different from like getting Lyme disease or a tick-borne disease. That's just more of like a local thing. Okay. It could be unpleasant and you can still get like a cellulitis or, you know, like a localized infection, but I don't study those sorts of things personally.
Sure. Okay. Talk a little bit about, and I don't know how much exactly you deal with this piece of it, but what do we know about Lyme disease and how it is getting into our body and doing all of, you know, doing all of the damage that it is doing. Yeah, let's start there.
Lyme disease is caused by this thing that we call a spirochetal bacteria. So unlike other regular types of bacteria, they just kind of like are this single-celled organism and just kind of like hangs out wherever it's at. Sometimes they form colonies or biofilms. You might have heard, you know, like those terms thrown around. A spirochetal bacteria has this corkscrew-like shape that they can kind of like spin their body and propel themselves. They have like an internal flagella. And so that's what causes this sort of like spiral shape that they can bore through their environment and be mobile. And so this makes them a little bit unique. Not a lot of bacteria that people know about have this form. Because of this form, I think like it can get into a lot of places in our body that normal bacteria might not be able to get to. And it seems like it seems like the bacteria tends to stay in like connective tissue and joint spaces. It also seems to like to go to the heart or the brain. So these are obviously places that can cause us a lot of problems. There's not a whole lot of depth of understanding about how the mechanism of Lyme disease infection works. So there's still a lot of big questions out there. And that's one of the things that the professor who started the Lyme disease group at UMD is interested in, understanding the mechanism behind Lyme disease infection. Why is it so hard to find, you know, like clear proof? Like, why is it so hard to have a test for Lyme disease? Why is it so hard to know how to get rid of this concept of like persistent or chronic Lyme? And even though the bacteria itself has been around for thousands and thousands of years, I mean, this isn't really a new thing. It's just like newly discovered, newly like beginning to be understood. So there's a lot of questions. One of the things that we think is because they have this like spiral sort of form is that one of the theories that we're investigating is that it can actually burrow into your macrophage in your immune system and avoid being like caught by your immune system. Because that's like the whole point is these cells called macrophages, they like seek out and try to engulf invading cells. But if the Borrelia can kind of like circumvent that process, they kind of evade the immune system. So there's some research being done on whether or not, you know, that's part of the puzzle. But these are things that are like, it's not just as easy as saying, like, oh, I'm going to go figure this out. There's a lot of trial and error in getting to the bottom of the story. So
wow. Yeah. I mean, it's just kind of fascinating. Just the mechanisms and the tools. I mean, our bodies, animals, the whole concept of the tick having the thing that kind of numbs you so you don't feel it. Well, it explains, obviously, you know, why do we not feel the tick right away and go, oh my gosh, I've got a tick on me. You know, it's that.
They're small, so they're very hard to feel that way. But yeah, so like the whole thing is really fascinating. One of the things that I think is the most fascinating to me is that this concept of like, this is not really new. This Lyme disease is not really new. It's just like newly understood. And there's a lot of different bacteria. In the United States, there's one main species of bacteria that causes Lyme disease. But in the European countries and like the Asian countries, there's more than one type of bacteria that cause Lyme disease. And so being able to identify what causes the Lyme disease issue is also kind of dependent on which bacteria you're dealing with, because sometimes there can be differences. So we still are doing a lot of studies and understanding the genetic composition of the bacteria and why, you know, like some countries have one type of Lyme disease causing bacteria and we have a different one. Earlier in, I want to say it was like 2011 or 2013, a new species of Borrelia was detected and has only been found in Minnesota so far. So So this is potentially concerning if, you know, like there's different strains even within our own country, and only in certain parts of our country. Mm-hmm. So we have this newer strain that causes Lyme disease like issues, but because we've only had such a limited experience with it, I don't think like they've really gotten very far in investigating what that really means.
Wow. Boy, that makes treatment for Lyme is already so tricky.
Yeah.
To add a whole nother level to that.
It's very difficult because still being elusive and finding a good way to test for it. You know, the problem with our test right now is that it's the tests that we have available are sometimes like 50% accuracy. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they are only detecting antibodies. So we can't detect antibodies until you've had the infection for a while and your immune system has had a robust enough response that there's enough antibodies there for our tests to catch it. So sometimes, you know, like you might have it for several weeks before there's enough immune response for our tests to have a good chance of success. By that point, you've already been sick for a while. So, and you know, by the time you can detect the antibodies, you're not even able to tell if it's an active infection or if it's an old infection.
Mm. What are, so the testing that you're doing with Lyme, the work that you're doing, what is the, you know, what is the information that you're trying to gain and what will we as the public hopefully eventually gain from that?
The lab that I am working with, we have this group called the Ixodes Outreach Project. Ixodes is the type of tick that spreads the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. So the type of tick that can spread Lyme disease is called Ixodes scapularis. And so like regular people might know this tick by the name black-legged tick or deer tick. Right now in Minnesota, this is really the only tick that can competently pass the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. But as I said like earlier, there's other species of bacteria that can spread this disease in other countries, just like there's other ticks in other parts of the country or in other parts of the world that could potentially spread this disease. But if you're looking just at Minnesota, right now, it's just this Ixodes that you're concerned with. So this is what our group mostly is focusing on, is we're focusing on the tick because we don't know a lot about how the disease itself like manifests and how it progresses. It's easiest right now to focus on the spread of the disease. And so that is like focusing on the tick. So we want to like study where this particular species of tick is found. What times of year are we finding the most activity? We want to know which of these ticks are actually carrying the bacteria. Because just because you have this Ixodes scapularis tick doesn't 100% mean that it's got the bacteria in it. Hmm. So part of the thing that we're looking at is we want to figure out like this risk assessment. And our group is using our StoryMap website to try to build a risk map. So we want to try to engage the public to help us send in tick specimens. And then we put a pin on our map everywhere that we found this species of tick. And then we're going through and we're testing the ticks to see if they're carrying that bacteria. So that over time we could, for example, say like this county has a high prevalence of this tick and this percentage of the ticks are actually carrying the disease causing bacteria. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that we're trying to do. Alongside of this, we're using some new equipment that can help us sequence the genome, the genetic material inside the tick. So this can tell us not just about the tick, but about all the genetic material that's inside the tick, all the different bacteria, all the different viruses, all the different fungus, you know, protozoans, whatever is in that tick, we can sequence it. And so that way we can start expanding our risk map to include other species of bacteria that could be infectious to people. So we're kind of like looking at a bigger picture of risk, and hopefully we'll be able to see, like we were talking about a little earlier, like there's other types of the bacteria that cause Lyme disease. So maybe we'll be able to see like if there's genetic differences within that bacteria and find like other species of the bacteria that cause Lyme disease.
So you said that only the deer tick carries Lyme.
Only the deer tick can spread Lyme.
Can spread it. So why is that?
Well, that's another excellent question that there's some uncertainty, but basically part of it has to do with like what happens inside the tick. So when a tick feeds, a tick is not like a person where it's got like this like impressive digestive system and the circulatory system and everything. It's basically just like a gut. And so when it feeds, like all that blood just kind of goes into this space that's its gut. And then the bacteria we figure is just kind of like hanging out in there. So what goes on inside that tick gut is probably part, at least part of the question or the answer. What happens to that bacteria? Is there something in this particular species of tick that is more conducive to this particular bacteria survival? Whatever goes on inside that gut, then there's another layer of the puzzle, because the bacteria has to get out of the gut to get to the salivary gland to be excreted when the tick goes to feed. So something about the process of being able to get out of the tick gut, get through, like, because ticks don't have a circulatory system, they just kind of have like this fluid called hemolymph that kind of fills up the rest of their body space.
Huh, okay.
So it has to be able to like migrate from the gut, migrate through this like hemolymph and get up to the salivary gland and then be there to be excreted. So each step of this way, there's a piece of the puzzle. What happens in the hemolymph? Is there something about the bacteria and the hemolymph in the Ixodes scapularis that's like makes this process more likely to happen? You know, there's a lot of pieces of the puzzle that have to be answered. And, you know, like some scientists study one piece of the puzzle, some scientists study another piece of the puzzle. And so these things take time. You know, it's like you can't always get an answer right away. You have to like try several different things. You know, molecular biology, like what happens on that molecular level, is super complex. And it always makes me think of this thing, like, have you ever heard of these domino exhibitions where there are these people that set up these incredibly huge and complex, like domino, like tip over courses?
Yes.
Well, I saw one once in a museum. It went up and down stairs and around the exhibits. And it took this guy like a week to set up. I mean, that's kind of like how molecular biology is. Like one domino sets off another domino, sets off another domino, and then sometimes they split and go different directions. And so you think you're following one path, but then you might get to a branch that splits off in like three or four different ways. And then you have to follow all those different ways and figure out where they come back together.
Wow.
So, you know, like the public sometimes I think gets frustrated with medicine and science because we can't give you a precise answer. Mm-hmm. But we're trying to chart this incredibly complex falling dominoes course. And you don't necessarily know where you're going to wind up when those dominoes start falling. And you have to follow it one domino at a time. And right. you've got to have subjects to test. You know, we got to get out there. We got to find the ticks. We got to collect the ticks. We got to collect enough ticks, because you can't just study one tick. You have to study like hundreds and hundreds, and you know, you have to find them wild. You know, there's certain things you can learn by setting it up in a lab, but it's not the same as finding out what's actually happening out in the wild.
Right.
And what happens here in Minnesota might not be the same as what happens in, you know, Lyme, Connecticut, or what happens in Germany, where they also have a lot of problems with Lyme disease. So
even though it seems like it's a tick, it should be a little tiny simplistic body. Right. Like,
yeah.
But well, right. Like you were saying, just the whole idea that, you know, that tick passes it on, but others don't. So it's that, so what's going on in other ticks? Is something in their saliva or their body or whatever that breaks it down and makes it totally inert? Or why is the, you know, how is the Lyme surviving and then getting back out again? It's like wild.
Then there's the whole additional piece of the puzzle where a lot of the evidence so far seems to support the idea that in the case of the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, the tick has to be attached and feeding for at least 24 hours for the risk of contracting Lyme disease to be significant. So if your tick bite, if you know it's been on you less than 24 hours, your chance of catching Lyme disease is pretty low. The longer it stays attached, 24 hours, 36 hours, 48 hours, it tends to like increase. And then there's kind of like this curve. So like as time goes on, the curve kind of goes up and up and up with the risk. And then it kind of like falls back off. Like there's this intermediate time where it seems like your risk is highest, but then at the early stages, it's lowest.
Okay. So if you end up having ticks on you, the quicker you can get them off, the better.
You definitely want to just like understand that tick checks, you know, like monitoring yourself for ticks is a critical part of tick bite prevention. You know, like wearing DEET, the EPA considers this safe. 30% is, I think they say, is like a good amount. And that's considered safe for pretty much anyone other than like small infants. So wearing a bug spray, there's some other types of bug repellents. I can look up the exact website, but there's like a CDC website for like different types of bug repellents that are recommended. There's also this permethrin, I think is how you say it. It's one of the ingredients in some of the topical domestic animal bug repellents. They don't recommend people use it on their skin, but you can spray it on your clothes, on your boots. You could spray it on the upholstery of your car. You could spray it on the upholstery of your lawn furniture. And that kind of like helps repel the ticks. So is this something about that that they just don't suggest you should put that directly on your skin, but on your clothes is good. So yeah, so like using some type of bug repellent. If you are going to be outside in areas where ticks are likely to be, even in the summertime, they do recommend long pants and like tuck them into your boots so that it's less of a chance that the tick's going to be able to climb up your pant leg. Wear long sleeves. This kind of just keeps them off of your arms as much. When we go out to like tick hunting for our research, we usually wear gloves and head nets and the whole nine yards, which is maybe not practical for the average person. But then again, like we're deliberately trying to find them.
Right.
But yeah, just as much as you may have the urge to go out hiking in a tank top and short shorts, it's probably not the wisest. Prevention is good, and failing keeping the ticks from biting you, the next best thing is just doing the tick checks. And if you're out in an area where you know ticks are likely to be, come home and take a hot shower. There's been some suggestion that ticks might not want to stay attached if they're exposed to really, really hot water. I don't know like there's any like concrete proof, but it certainly wouldn't hurt. And I think like a briskly washing your scrubbing yourself with some hot soapy water is never a bad thing anyway. So you might as well try it. We do know like ticks will desiccate pretty quickly. So drying any like hiking clothes and super high heat in the dryer for at least 10 minutes will like reduce the chance that the ticks will like come out of the dryer and still be able to like crawl off and get in your drawers or off of your clothes next time you wear them. So
okay. Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions is like, what if, you know, how long can they hang out on your clothes? I know I remember being with somebody somewhere and they had taken off their socks and they had noticed a tick at some point. They didn't do anything about it, but the next day the tick was like still there.
Ticks, you could say, have like slow metabolisms. They only need to take like one breath a day.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
They only eat like 3 times in their entire life. So, I mean, they can live a long time on very little. They're very hardy, with the exception of dry, hot environments. So the only thing that you can really do to like kill a tick is desiccate it, dry it out. So yeah, that's why the dryer is a really good trick. Wow. If you've got a really hot dryer, just throw your stuff in there for at least 10 minutes and you should be good. Don't pack it in there really tight. Like I'm talking about, like throw in just your hiking outfit in the dryer. Yeah. These ticks, I mean, the ticks don't just live like one season. That's kind of like a misconception.
Okay.
They can survive over winter. They kind of like go down into like the leaf litter or the dead grass, and they just kind of like hunker down until the temperature warms back up. Especially like because they need to feed to move on to each life stage. I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a huge time limit and when that has to happen. So, I mean, a tick can go a couple, 2-3 years if it needs to between feeds.
Wow. That is so amazing to me.
There is kind of like a seasonal peak. So springtime, it kind of is depending on where you are. I mean, we have a few different like seasonal like zones in Minnesota even, but ticks activity tends to be highest when the weather starts to get above 40 degrees. And then for like the next like month or so after that point. So like here in the Duluth area, we were getting ticks as early as early to mid-April, because we had most of the snow off the ground kind of by that time, but not a whole lot. And then like just recently in the areas we've been monitoring the last couple weeks, when the nights have stayed mostly above freezing and the days have been mostly above 40, that's when we start to see like this peak of activity. And that's when like most of the adults are looking to feed and to mate and to feed and lay eggs. Then that will kind of die down a little bit as those adults complete that part of their life stage. And then there'll be kind of like a lull. And then any of the ticks that like have managed to lay eggs, then we'll have like the larval spike a little bit later in the summer. We might see also like a spike of like those nymphal ticks as they kind of like go through their life stages. Sometimes you'll still see ticks into the fall. So like even though the weather gets cool, deer hunters and like people who are out like hunting turkey and pheasant, whatever, you know, like seasons you have for hunting in the fall, sitting in a deer blind is like actually kind of risky business because you know that's an area where there's likely to be deer. So, you know, you could definitely come across ticks even late in the fall.
With deer come deer ticks.
Yeah.
So the bullseye that we traditionally hear about, I have heard people say that they've had cases of Lyme without the bullseye. So is that this other strain that we're talking about, or is it just, yeah, the bullseye is a good way to think about it, but it's not 100%.
So the thing with the bullseye rash is that unfortunately, like not everybody's going to get it. And the percentage of people that don't get it can be quite high. So if you have a true bullseye rash, then that's a dead giveaway. You definitely have Lyme disease. A true bullseye rash only exists if you have Lyme disease, but there's still a lot of people who can have it and not have it. And I don't know that it makes a difference what species of bacteria, because like in the United States, especially in Minnesota, there's primarily just one major type of bacteria that causes it. There is another species of tick that's more to like the south, southwest that can cause Lyme disease. We don't tend to get that tick up here very often. So I don't think it's like what species of bacteria has anything to do with whether or not you get the rash.
Okay.
It's just an unfortunate thing. Like if you get it, then yeah, we know, but you don't have to always get the rash. Okay. And sometimes like the size of the rash can vary for no reason that I'm aware of. So if you have a really small rash in a really inconspicuous place, there might be people who get the rash, but they just never know it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So like if you live alone and you get it on your back, you might never know.
Right. Right. Yeah, exactly.
if you were to get it like underneath your hair, on your behind,
mm-hmm. you know, right?
You won't know.
Right.
You know, you might know is if you live with somebody who happens to see you changing clothes or in the shower and they're like, hey, you've got a funny rash.
So if we get ticks, so we talk, the deer tick and Lyme is connected, but I'm thinking about like these other ticks. Is that where we get other tick-borne diseases?
So yes, there's something like 8 or 9 different tick-borne illnesses that are common in Minnesota, or at least known to be around in Minnesota. So some of them can be transmitted by this deer tick. We talk a lot about Lyme because that's what our lab is particularly interested in. But through the bite of one deer tick, you could get multiple different types of bacterial infections or other microorganisms causing infections. And a lot of the research, some of the most common ones that have been looked at is like this combination of Lyme disease, babesiosis, and anaplasmosis. Those like three tend to crop up a lot at the same time. So some of the other ones, there's one I think called ehrlichiosis. There's this new one that has been getting a lot of attention lately, and the name is escaping me. But yeah, I mean, one deer tick in one bite can spread more than just Lyme disease. There's other types of ticks. Like in Minnesota, we also have a lot of these things that people sometimes call dog ticks or wood ticks. Those are not able to spread the Lyme disease bacteria, but they can cause other tick-borne illnesses. So it is a good idea anytime you get a tick bite to remove it right away, regardless of what type of tick it is, and then pay attention for symptoms. A lot of the symptoms start out very similar, just like a flu-like illness. So, you know, if you've been out in the woods and chances are good that you've been bit by a tick, or if you for sure know you've been bit by a tick, and the next few days you start developing serious flu-like symptoms, you should definitely seek medical advice.
So you guys are collecting ticks, and like you said earlier, that you're encouraging people to help you guys with that. So what does that look like? And I know that you have a website, and I will put that in the show notes for sure. But what does it look like if somebody collects a tick? What do they do? Yeah, talk us through that a little bit.
So if you want to reach out to us and request a tick kit, the kit comes with a little approximately 1 by 2 inch, like little Ziploc style baggie. And usually we put some hand sanitizer gel in there. That just helps preserve the specimen and keep it from getting like all dried out and potentially like moldy and gross. So with the situation being as it is right now, where getting a hold of hand sanitizer has become a little bit more of a challenge. I'm not sure if we can guarantee that they will always have that. But so yeah, the tick kit has this little baggie. It's got some tick identification cards and information about Lyme disease and tick-borne illnesses. We include this thing called a tick key, which is just like this little device that's supposed to help you remove the ticks in a safer and easier manner. So we send these out free of charge. Things are a little slow right now because COVID-19 has everybody kind of social distancing and we can't get into our lab right now. But the intention is that we will get these out to people who request them and they can send us specimens. If you don't have a tick kit, you're still welcome to collect specimens and just send them to us in a little sandwich baggie, kind of the zipper. I mean, Ziploc is a trademark, but it doesn't have to be Ziploc, but it should have that airtight seal. Because if you just use like one of the fold-over baggies, they can climb out. They can climb out super easy. But yeah, so you can send them to us. The things that we need to know about them, if you're going to send them to us, is where you found the tick, and be as specific as you possibly can. If you are capable of downloading the actual like coordinates from where you're at, that's fabulous, but it's not super necessary. What's really just helpful too is like, say like, oh, I was at, you know, this state park, or, oh, I was, you know, out in my property at the intersection near blank and blank in such and such city. That's helpful too. We have some folks working with us from the university who are doing our mapping. And so just being able to give them a good idea of where to put the pin on the map. If you self-report, then you can like click on the map and you can tell us that way. So yeah, so those are the things that are super important, is where you found it, when you found it, if it was like attached to a human, a dog, a cat, a horse, whatever. So that way, like if it fed on something before you sent it into us, we kind of know like where it's coming from.
Okay.
So those are like the big things. If you would like to be in contact with us and you want to share your name and address, email, phone number, that way we could update you. Sometimes it takes a while. I think like sometimes people hope like they send us this tick and we can tell them right away if it's carrying Lyme disease bacteria. It doesn't work that way. It sometimes takes months or even years because we are very underfunded. Mm. And so most of the research is done by undergraduates. So they come and go. but we did recently get, I think we're about like 90% done with the specimens that were sent to us in 2018.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Have started some of the specimens that were sent to us in 2019. We're running about a year to a year and a half lag time right now.
Okay. So you would be potentially sending in the tick alive, right? You're just, the job is to get it off your body in a bag and then mail it in.
Yeah. If you send it to us, just in a bag by itself, it will probably live in that bag for a while unless it like dries out or gets smashed in postal processing. if you put it in a bag with a little bit of hand sanitizer, especially if you get one of the kits from us that has hand sanitizer, it'll drown or be killed by the hand sanitizer, that's okay. We can use ticks either way, alive or dead. We can do different things with them depending on what state they're in, but they're useful to us either way. Sometimes if you send them to us without any hand sanitizer, depending on like how long they're sitting in the bag before they get to us, sometimes they arrive in kind of like moldy, nasty condition. Mm. Those are a little bit more challenging to use. Occasionally, like I said, sometimes they get smashed up pretty bad in postal processing. And sometimes I'm not sure if we'll be able to get much out of those. But DNA tends to be pretty sturdy. So there is sometimes information that we can get doing DNA testing. So we won't turn anything down.
But if you happen to have a bubble envelope, that's not a bad idea, huh?
Yeah. I mean, originally we were asking people to send back these little tubes that we were giving them, but that posed a lot of problems because you can't just put a tube in a mailing envelope, like a regular mailing envelope. Those have to be put in an actual like padded envelope or a box. Right. But the little Ziploc bags you can put in a regular envelope with like usually just one stamp is sufficient.
Okay. You don't have to declare livestock or anything on the envelope.
If you're like a really good tick collector and you get lots and lots of ticks, it does become helpful if you can split them out by like, you know, like no more than like caught within no more than like 5 to 7 days of each other. So like if you caught a whole bunch of ticks this week and then like a couple weeks later you happen to catch a whole bunch more ticks, it would be nice if they were separate because there's like a few weeks in between.
Sure.
But like if you caught some today and some tomorrow, those could probably all just go together. But
Okay. Well, that's good to know.
The Minnesota Department of Health has some really excellent materials on tick-borne diseases and tick bite prevention, what to do if you're bit by a tick. They have some great little videos. They're not a huge investment of your time. Mostly they're like between 2 to 5 minutes in length. They have some that are targeted specifically for young children, done in like cartoon form. So these are all excellent resources for community members with families, people who don't have scientific background and they want to know like, what do I need to know? the resources are excellent. Some of the people I collaborated with in some of my previous work did these materials. And if you have additional questions, you're free to contact us at the Exodes Outreach Project or the people at the Minnesota Department of Health. They're always interested in, you know, trying to get the word out to the community, and they'll take questions. So yeah, so if you look through the materials and you still aren't sure, go ahead and ask. The Exodes Outreach Project is trying to assemble this risk map. And so we really like to promote our story map website where people can contribute the tick collection and get their little tick will get a pin on the map. And because right now we're mostly still like just in the collecting phase, it's just like pins of where people have found ticks.
Okay.
I mean, we don't put your personal identification in there in any way, but it will say like the best approximation of the location. So if you send us coordinates, we can put an exact pin. But if you just send us like the city or an intersection, then it's more approximate. But yeah, there's always an indicator there. And then later, the idea is as we're able to get through the assays and testing for the different bacteria and pathogenic organisms, we can go back in and add that to the pin and say, like, this tick was submitted from this location and it was found to be carrying this, or it was negative for that. So over time, we'll be building this risk map.
Okay.
So it can be a tool for people in the community to know like where they're likely to encounter ticks that are potentially carrying infectious microorganisms, or other scientists can use it to help us track the spread of the disease, because really in the Minnesota area, we've really only been seeing this as a rising problem for like the last 20 or 30 years.
Okay.
So, usually it was really limited to like the Connecticut, East Coast, New York, those East Coast states around Connecticut. But it's moved. And so that's part of the puzzle too. It's like, why is it suddenly moving? Why are we now finding more of it here? And so part of our work is to track where these ticks are cropping up that are carrying this bacteria. There's started to be some reports of it becoming more common now in Canada.
Mm.
So we need to track that as part of the puzzle. And so that's one of the great advantages of starting to assemble this risk map. Our big push too is to involve the community, because as I've talked about before, like, these things are not easy to do. They take time, and the more people you can get involved and the more samples you can get, chances are better that you'll be able to get more information to work from.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always great to involve the community. It helps the community kind of like own the project and understand better what's going on. And we use it for teaching and training undergraduates, which is also a very important part of our Exodes Outreach Project program, is, you know, training up the next batch of scientists who maybe will help us solve some of these questions that are so important to be answered.
Right. Well, and I can imagine, like you're saying, you're looking for risk areas, and I can imagine the process of the more you have each year from all these different areas, you determine if the risk area is a consistent risk area or if it's a moving risk area.
And, you know, it's important too, because we talk about how the ticks are going through these life stages. And so you have to understand, like, if the tick population is actually established in these areas, if you're only finding adult ticks in these areas, it's possible that they're riding in on birds or larger animals and being sporadically deposited, and maybe one female lays a batch of eggs. Is that really an established population at that point? So maybe the first year that you're monitoring a site, you might be only find a couple of adult ticks because they've just like rode in on another animal, but maybe in a few more years, suddenly they become an established population because these few ticks that got, you know, like dropped in by chance are now mating and laying eggs.
Right. Well, my gosh, and those suckers can hang on pretty darn good too. So it's kind of, you know, it's not like an animal going through the brush or flying or whatever is going to, the tick is going to drop off, you know. They seem to hang on, in my experience with ticks, they seem to hang on pretty well.
Yeah, they do. So I mean, there's lots of things we want to investigate. I mean, is it like, we know that the bacteria usually originate from mice and small rodents, but part of the puzzle is these ticks can feed on so many different animals. They do sometimes feed on birds. They do feed on humans. They do feed on deer. And these larger animals and birds can have bigger ranges. You know, people can be transmitting these ticks. You know, you go, maybe you live in the cities and you go up to, you know, Voyagers and you spend, you know, time out there, and then you go back to the cities, and all the places you stop on the way, if you pick up ticks, you're like spreading those ticks as you go back and forth up and down the state.
Right. Well, not to mention getting on a plane. Yeah.
The migratory birds, like the way they can, you know,
right,
spread the ticks. Right. You know, you just have a couple ticks climb on a bird, and a few hours later, they can be in a totally different environment. So,
right. Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating stuff. I mean, Lyme is such, you know, it's something that I, through the work that I've done, I've certainly, the amount of people that I know that have had it, that have healed from it, that have lived with it, that have, you know, really suffered through some big stuff, you know, this is kind of a big thing that we're trying to figure out here. I mean, you know, you had it, and I don't know, you know, how long it kind of hung in there for you, but I know people who have spent years of their life trying to get it out of their body.
Well, I feel like I caught it right away. So I feel like I probably had a fairly successful treatment outcome. People first started reporting this bullseye rash and like the Lyme arthritis like symptoms back in the 1960s.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like in Lyme, Connecticut, that's where the name Lyme disease came from, because Lyme, Connecticut, there was this huge community of people, a lot of children who are coming down with these rashes and then developing arthritis. And it's a little bit more maybe excusable in adults, but you don't usually see arthritis in children. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of, I think, what kicked it all off back in the 1960s and 70s, is that there was these groups of parents who were finally getting together and being like, this is not normal. You have to figure out what this is. And shortly thereafter, it started getting more attention. And then in 1980, this William Bergdorfer actually identified this Borrelia bacteria as causing this phenomenon that became known as Lyme disease. Wow. So from there it spread. But in the beginning, it was mostly centered in the states around Connecticut.
Okay.
Interesting. So it's migrated into the Midwest, and it's particularly like the Northern West. It's actually quite a problem, I guess, in Wisconsin too. But that migrating up to our area is only just been like in the last 20 or 30 years, whereas like the whole tail goes back almost 80 years.
Okay. Before you go, if you would give the email address, just to have people have that actual email address, and then either what they can Google or the website to the U of M study.
So the email is exodesoutreach@d.umn.edu. That's exodes, IXODES, outreach.
Okay. I was going to ask you how to spell exodes. I'm like, I have no idea how to spell that. Okay.
Then our story map website is z, as in zoo, .umn.edu/exodes, IXODES.
Awesome. All right. Well, that gives people a pretty good idea of how to find you, how to send in a tick, because I think that's a pretty interesting thing right there, to be able to be a part and help that, you know. And then what do you do with this tick when you, I mean, think about, I'm just thinking of the people who are, what do I do with this tick? So they like burn it, you know. Well, here, no, put it in a baggie, send it on in. It could actually do some good.
We'll take your ticks. We'll take your ticks.
In the name of science, for crying out loud. Awesome.
And we do community outreach presentations too. So if any of your listeners are interested in having myself or Dr. Clark, who's a member of our Ixodes Outreach Project, come and talk to your group about Lyme disease or tick bite prevention. You know, we are open to those opportunities as well.
Awesome. Well, with groups heading out into camping things and stuff like that, it's kind of nice to know what you're looking for.
It's a little harder to do those right now under COVID-19 restrictions, but
yes.
One of the things we might be working on is just, you know, like some Zoom presentations or some recorded presentations. So
cool. You could show actual ticks that people have sent in or that you have to show.
You can go to our blog and you can see some pictures of our tick eggs.
Oh, the ones that are in the process of hatching?
Well, I don't know if they're in the process of hatching yet. They were just recently laid.
How long does it take a tick egg to hatch?
I don't know. I kind of have heard it's about 30 days.
Really? That is amazing. You'd think just for those little buggers, it wouldn't take that long.
Yeah, well, we'll find out because I'm monitoring it.
So. Okay. Well, hey, if you need something to watch on the web, if the news is getting too much, go watch the tick eggs sit there and try to hatch.
the ones I'm watching now, they started getting laid mid-May. So
it's been a while.
I think it kind of, they get laid a little bit at a time too. It's not like they just like, boom, eggs.
Oh, okay.
It's kind of like an egg laying process.
Interesting.
Okay. So they may not all hatch at the same time either. So.
Right. Oh, wow. Huh. Interesting. Well, that's probably easier on the mom. Like, there's all these little ticks running around. They come out at little different times.
Mom dies.
Oh.
She lays her eggs and she dies.
Oh, okay.
You can lay something like 2,000 eggs.
That's a lot of ticks.
And they come out near her head.
Oh.
So you can see if you go to the blog and you look at the picture that we have posted right now, you see like this big, like sort of grayish blob. That's the mother tick. And the tick's eggs have just kind of like piled out and covered like her head and then like spewed out into the bottom of the container.
Wow. This is so fascinating. Okay.
Grossly fascinating. Yes.
Oh my gosh. It's so fascinating to see how many different ways things can be done in the animal world. And, you know,
maybe we should do like the tick podcast, like series, you know, we can think about this. Maybe we should have like different little podcast series you can set up throughout, you know, like the summer.
There we go. Sounds very intriguing.
Just the one talking about the tick. And tick identification, and then you have one talking just about like the history of Lyme disease. Did you know? Have you ever heard of that Utsi, the Iceman they found like in the Alps or whatever, frozen?
Yeah, yes.
He had Lyme disease. They found Borrelia bacteria in him. That's how we know that it's been around at least 5,300 years.
That is so wild. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so if you want to come up with an actual plan, I could get you lots of podcast fodder.
I guess so. Wow. Well, you know, hey, it's fascinating it's fascinating what there is to know that you didn't know there was to know.
And I don't know if it's creepy or not, but I know it.
Well, hey, yeah. Well, I think sometimes it is just that understanding of how much, like this little simple creature that seems so simple is not simple at all. That's what's so fascinating.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, there's so many different tick-borne diseases that most people never even hear of. We could do a whole series on tick-borne diseases.
Sweet. Well, thank you. This was fun. Sweet.
This was fun.
Yes, this was great.
I will include the website and the email address in the show notes, as well as a link to the Lyme disease support group here in Duluth, Minnesota, and a few other articles. And I wanted to mention that they are focusing the study on the northern Midwest and Lake Superior region. However, if you are anywhere else, surrounding states or anywhere, and you think you have a black-legged deer tick, Ixodes, which are all the same tick, you are absolutely welcome to send that in and just be really clear about where it is and where you got the tick from so that can be tracked. And that might give them some information if the tick ends up in other places. Cole had mentioned a couple options for tick repellent. And I know there are many people who have issues with DEET. And I would love to ask people if you have something that you feel has been effective for you if you're not comfortable with DEET, to put it on the Facebook post or put it on the notes page with the podcast. You are also welcome to get a hold of me through Facebook Messenger or email, whatever works. I know I also see oil of lemon eucalyptus listed in multiple places on the web that I have done a little research. I highly suggest you do your own, both on its effectiveness and how to apply it. doTERRA has a essential oil blend called Terra Shield. And I know I've certainly seen that listed in some of the reading that I've been doing. I have some of my own, and I know that my experience was pretty good with it. I can't say that there were ticks in the areas that I was trotting through when I was using it. However, I felt like it did a decent job with the bugs anyway, and I felt like I had to apply it more frequently, but quite frankly, if I can stay away from the bug spray, most cases I'm going to be pretty happy with dealing with that. So again, do your own research. Jan Tomeno, if you happen to be listening to this, you are more than welcome to send me a message or pop on the Facebook page, etc., and throw in your 2 cents worth. If you are not familiar with Jan Tomeno, she is a certified clinical aromatherapist. She's also a friend and guest of the podcast, episode 85. We talked about essential oil safety. I do not remember if we talked about bug spray, tick repellent, any of that on there or not. But if you do have questions, she would be a great resource. And I know there are many other people that work closely with essential oils as well. Take care. Until next time, may you continue to find the pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle. Bye-bye.